welcome to the Sagebrush Variety Show, sagebrushvariety.org, political commentary and satire. On this week's show, we're back to our regular format, the Peak Oil Check-In by Carl Ettmeyer. This week, energy slaves take no holiday on Labor Day. Today we have the premiere of the new radio serial play. This is Ukiah Digby for Coroner. It's a political comedy. It was our first one, and we're playing it now for syndicated community radio. The Sagebrush Variety Show Farm Report is on Hot Peppers this week, and we've got an essay, Ode to Bicyclists. We also have a repeat performance of Homeland Security, Level Red. This episode is entitled Breach 'em. But first, Bucky Bacaw's Backyard Chicken Broadcast on egg production. I'm producer Gwen Sankirico. Enjoy the show.
Bucky Bacaw here with the Backyard Chicken Broadcast. On a previous episode, I discussed the merits of the eggs laid by backyard chickens as compared to eggs laid in factory farms. To sum up, grocery store eggs are noxious and backyard eggs are glorious. Of course, eggs are only one reason, not even the most compelling reason, to sign on to the Bucky Bacaw agenda of a chicken or three in every backyard, rural, urban, or suburban, worldwide. The truth is, having backyard chickens empowers us chickeners and frees us from the oppressive yoke of corporate food production, because chickens supercharge your garden by providing pesticide-free bug control, excellent tilling, compost management, and fertilizer production, in addition to providing companionship and entertainment. There really is no sensible argument against living with chickens, but because the human connection to agriculture has been all but severed by corporate takeover, most people I meet tell me, Bucky, I'd love to have chickens in my outdoor space, but I'm a city person. I don't know the first thing about egg production. The truth is, you don't have to know much, because the chicken knows egg production, and all you gotta do is provide the basics, food and shelter. I've covered those topics on previous episodes, and will again, but for web links on nutrition, coop building, legal questions, and other nitty-gritties, visit the Bucky page at sagebrushvariety.org. First thing I need to clear up is that a hen doesn't need a rooster to lay eggs. Roosters are needed to fertilize eggs in order for them to hatch into chicks, but a chicken goes through its reproductive cycle, including producing eggs, regardless of reproductive activity, just like other animals, including humans. Some of you are saying, duh. But I promise you that some, even many of your fellow listeners, are saying, no kidding. Not only is it a surprisingly common contemporary confusion, but the ancient Greeks were also a little bit hazy on the question. I've come across some conflicting information, but all my sources agree that the ancient Greeks believed the wind could fertilize an egg. The Greeks believed a chicken egg that wasn't sired by a rooster must have been fathered by the wind, known as Zephyr eggs. Aristotle, the top thinker at the time, believed that all eggs, of any species, were the products of the male seed growing in the womb. The only way to explain the immaculately conceived egg of a virgin, or spinster, was that hens who sniff at the wind in spring had absorbed the wind's seed. Others believed the wind blew its seed up from the other end. The notion that the sole contribution of the species of any female to birth was the womb was a misconception that persisted in male-dominated scientific circles for thousands of years. I have to wonder if regular folks who raise chickens, including, no doubt, many women, shared this notion. Other sources refer to Zephyr eggs as eggs laid with no shell. That's a fairly recent development. A shellless, or thin-shelled egg, is actually the result of calcium deficiency in the hen, which is just one reason why you need to make sure your flock gets fed right, especially because an ongoing calcium deficiency will not only affect the eggs of a laying hen, but will eventually result in bone degeneration and a dramatic decline in health. As far as calcium is concerned, hens can get calcium from the bugs they eat in a healthy backyard, as well as from a number of vegetable sources. Beet greens, cilantro, chard, kale, and lettuce are examples of inexpensive calcium sources the Bacaw flock enjoys. However, Most laying flocks will require supplemental calcium. The shells of their own eggs is one source. Just make sure you grind or chop them up before putting them out with feed. Otherwise, they may associate the sight of an egg with food and begin to eat their own eggs before you get a chance. Another common supplement for small flock birders is ground up oyster shells. I've done a detailed show on nutrition, and you can check the web links on the Bucky page of sagebrushvariety.org for more information. Back to what you can expect from a laying hen. The textbook laying pattern is an egg every 25 hours, starting in the morning on the first day and getting progressively later until it gets into the evening hours. A hen won't lay an egg in the evening, so they won't start again until the next morning when the cycle begins anew. At some point, a hen, or the hen's inner biological voice, will decide it's time to try to hatch some chicks. That's known as a broody hen. Other birds get broody when conditions are ideal to successfully hatch and raise as many chicks as possible. Normally, that has to do with season, or by the number of eggs, or clutch, that are on the nest. Chicken broodiness is less clearly tied to survival imperatives, and much more tied to breeding. Certain breeds, such as Silkies, are very broody. An individual Silky may lay an egg and immediately go into hatch mode. They are known to take a liking to an elegant rock or other objects vaguely resembling an egg and trying to hatch that. Even male Silkies get broody. Polish hens, on the other hand, may live out their entire lives without ever attempting to hatch a chick. A broody hen will stop laying eggs. They're less likely to get broody if you regularly remove the eggs from their nest. Egg laying ceases during the 2 to 3 months of winter, when the daylight hours are shortest, unless you do like some commercial hatcheries and keep chickens in a lighted barn. If you ask me, constant artificial light is a mild form of torture. How would you like it? Indeed, I believe it's one of the techniques used at Guantanamo Bay. It would be nice to have eggs year-round, but I also want my chickens to be happy. I figured recently that my 3 young chickens produce a yearly average of 1.5 eggs a day. That's a pretty steady diet of eggs, and I'm satisfied. Another thing that will affect egg laying is molting, the chicken version of shedding. This usually happens in summer or fall, but varies by climate, from breed to breed, and even from bird to bird. Some chickens molt gradually, and you may not even notice, but often it's a dramatic and temporarily ugly process. Molting hens' energies are usually diverted into feather replacement and maintaining the right body temperature, so don't be surprised if egg production slows or halts temporarily. And once again, make sure you provide nutritious, balanced, and interesting diet to support your hens through their draining reproductive cycles. Chickens will lay eggs for many years. Some say most of their 10 to 15 year natural lifespan. In diminishing numbers, of course, but they still lay. A commercial hatchery will slaughter a hen who's past her prime because it starts to cut into their profit margin. But you have the option of keeping them around for bug control, fertilizer production, companionship, or to discipline any new chickens that may get added to your flock, in addition to a few eggs now and then. That's it for this week. This is Bucky Bacall, signing off. I had a good time. Bucky Bacall's Backyard Chicken Broadcast was produced by the Sagebrush Variety Show with support from Boise Community Radio and the Green Institute.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
Did you enjoy Labor Day weekend? And did you remember to thank all the energy slaves who made your enjoyment possible? What's an energy slave, you ask? Energy slaves don't look like the workers honored on Labor Day. The lineman restoring your power after a storm, the backhoe operator digging a house foundation, or the nurse changing a patient's bandages. They symbolize the energy sources that heat and cool the buildings and power the machines that run our society. One energy slave represents the power output from a human working as hard as a slave driver might drive a slave. A strong human working hard all day can put out roughly 100 watts of power, or 1/7 of a horsepower. Working that hard 12 hours per day, 6 days per week, 50 weeks per year, a human can produce about 1 million BTU of energy, the amount of energy contained in a mere 8 gallons of gasoline. From oil alone, 150 energy slaves serve the average person in the U.S. The electrical line worker drives a truck everywhere. The backhoe makes digging a foundation in flinty soil seem effortless. And the nurse uses bandages and medicines made with and from oil in a hospital heated with oil. But now, the slaves are starting to slip away. World crude oil production seems to have peaked in May 2005, and production at existing fields is declining at 4-5% per year. The world peak and decline have been forecast for over 50 years. We know oil is non-renewable. U.S. oil production peaked in 1970 and has halved since then. The permanent decline in world oil production is inevitable. Will we see some slight rebound before the long descent? Maybe, maybe not. In either case, we're not prepared. A 2005 study for the U.S. Department of Energy concluded that to successfully prepare for peak oil, the U.S. needed to begin 20 years before the peak, and to give it an Apollo Project level of effort. Yet peak oil may already have arrived. In Vermont, we're especially vulnerable. We have long, cold winters, a rural population dependent on cars, and we use oil to import 95% of our food and to grow all of it. Vermont has no in-state sources of oil, and the U.S. as a whole imports about 2/3 of its oil. As world oil production declines, oil-producing countries will likely use a larger proportion of their remaining production themselves. Oil may become scarcer faster in Vermont than in the world as a whole. It's past time for us as individuals and society to start learning to live with fewer of these energy slaves. The key is to use energy much more efficiently and relocalize our economy, using food, renewable energy, and materials from our own backyards or state, rather than from across the globe. Much of this we know how to do, and some things can be done quickly, like cutting out some trips and taking others by bicycle or carpool or public transportation. Some things take more time. David Zuckerman, a farmer and chair of the House Agriculture Committee, estimated that with a massive effort it would take a single growing season to replace imported food in Vermont. But what will we eat in the meantime if a hurricane or a terrorist attack crimped the flow of oil that transports 95% of our food to us from outside the state? Some things take even longer. We could save over $450 million in heating expenses by investing $15 million a year in efficiency for just 10 years. And that's calculated with oil costing about 1/3 of what it does now. We could gradually and stably increase our local farmers' ability to produce food for us by buying 90% local food for all the state employee cafeterias, prisons, and other state institutions, and helping schools and businesses to do the same. We could build out passenger rail and increase bus routes and frequency. Individuals can grow more of their own food, drive less, bicycle more, heat with sustainably harvested wood, and super-insulate their homes. The human workers honored on Labor Day are vulnerable to the effects of peak oil, as energy prices may double again, and many businesses are likely to close in the economy, no longer fueled by so many energy slaves. We need robust public policy to protect the most vulnerable and to help us to work together to learn to live well with fewer energy slaves. I'm Carl Ettinger, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
You're listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show, political commentary and satire with an irreverent twist. The The Sagebrush Players are pleased to present Ukiah Digby for Coroner, the inspiring, heartbreaking, action-packed, bloody, and mildly amusing tale of an honest citizen's campaign for local political office and the life lessons learned by everyone involved, the candidates, their campaign staffs, and county residents. In this first installment of Ukiah Digby for Coroner, we will meet Umatilla Kennewick, county coroner for the past 28 years, in which she has never been through a contested election, although you wouldn't know it from her fundraising efforts and substantial war chest. Ukiah Digby. Ukiah has held almost every job imaginable, from janitor to tool salesman to soap opera star. He's volunteered as a community activist for causes from rescuing orphaned kitty cats to lobbying for organic food standards to defending labor laws and the right to unionize. This year, he decided the only way to rescue anything, including his own embattled spirit, is to throw himself into local politics. Lyndon Cuttown, Umatilla Kennewick's campaign manager. This cynical jerk has the dirt on everyone in town. Every campaign he has managed in 13 years has ended in victory. It doesn't hurt that he only works for dominant party candidates with tight connections to the town's wealthiest industrialists and welfare ranchers. But what really locks his perfect record is his utter ruthlessness. Martellaine Mascarpone, Ukiah Digby's campaign manager. Recent graduate from a fancy college known for its political science program, this is her first gig as campaign manager. It pays a little more than her last job at the Le Fondue, the fanciest restaurant in town, which isn't saying much considering they specialize in skewered bacon strips dipped in nacho cheese. She's an idealist, a liberal, and not a little naive. Jenny Jett, elected elections official overseeing all elections of elected officials. Stan Popufke, media journalist and columnist. If you don't know the difference, that's okay, neither does he. And an assortment of leaders of local nonpartisan and honestly totally objective interest groups. The strains of martini-soaked piano music drift from the historic Spaten building across Main Street to the bright blue waters of the fountains in front of City Hall. A small crowd is milling about, the usual suspects of the city's political scene, their families, and some press.
Lyndon, why in the heck do I pay you to manage my campaign after 28 years of running unopposed? Your pointless salary could pay for an extra barrel of top-shelf martinis, a gross of those Swedish meatballs I love so dearly, and a dang hunky Swedish masseuse for my victory party.
Oma, please, keep it down.
Lyndon, you will address me as Ms. Kennewick until further notice. Try never.
Fine. Nevertheless, it really would be so kind of you, in your wisdom and beneficence, to be aware that God's Channel is here with their shotgun mics, and they'd love to pick up some audio of you describing your appetites. I ask you not to rile the TV media by declaring one of their most feared and respected CEOs dead just because he didn't look at your new breasts even once during the governor's ball.
What's the point of being county coroner if I can't have a little fun now and then?
Well, we can discuss that in detail at a later time. And if you weren't paying me, people might suspect you weren't quite professional enough for the job, or would wonder why you need so many donations. Or someone with less integrity than I might challenge your rudderless campaign and sink it so bad it couldn't be saved by last-minute election fraud.
Lighten up, you weenie. When was the last time I had opposition? Let me think. Never. I've got this sweet little gig nailed until I decide my campaign chest is big enough to disappear mysteriously in an apparent theft a couple days before the election, just like my daddy did 28 years ago. And in the great Kennewick tradition, the party hacks will nominate my son Ferris, who will selflessly accept the position for the good of Idaho and our party.
Very amusing, to say the least. Please, Oma, Miss Kennewick, please just button one more button higher on your blouse and try not to look at that cocktail napkin so much when you read your speech.
Whatever!
Is this mic working? Testing! Testing! Can everyone hear me in the back? It is my honor as an elections official to officiate at this official ceremony for candidates filing for public office. We have a great slate of candidates this year. Someone is running for every single elected position in our county, and we even have one contested election. That's right, two people running for an elected office, which despite the fact that it's going to cost your county several thousands of election dollars more, Heck, I eat at least $100 of imported triangular chocolate to get through the elections week. As I was saying, despite the cost, that's just the price of democracy, and I say we're getting a pretty good deal out of it because I have every confidence that this race will be a heartwarming tale of love, loss, betrayal, and redemption. There will be laughter, and there will be tears. Life lessons will be learned. We will eat chocolate. So, with that said, it is my official honor to introduce Umatilla Kennewick, County Coroner for the past 28 years, during which her exemplary performance was most certainly the reason she has never faced a challenger. My classmate at Beulah High, go Bashers, even though no one would guess she was the same age as me, Umatilla Kennewick.
Thanks, Jenny. Hey there, Stan. Good to see you could make it. Hi, Jebediah. How's the kids? Lyndon, it's good to see you. Yo, Benton! Sup, Tyler? Howdy, Allie. And hello to the two long-haired liberal artistic characters in the back who I haven't seen before. You're probably not from around here, but I just want to be the first one to tell you we have a very inclusive community here, and we're all very glad to see all types. I look forward to personally shaking your hands after my speech. Anyways, I'm a sixth-generation Idahoan. Can't go back any further than that. I have a husband, 7 children, and 49 grandchildren, all of whose names I can remember. I went to Beulah High, go Bashers! And since I grew up and got elected coroner, I've supported all the teams in my district. Some a little less. Anyways, on the stuff that really matters, I've been your coroner for 28 years, and hope to be until I get carried away on a stretcher. Because I'm truly dedicated to the selfless service that this position requires. I'm endorsed by the Chamber of Commerce, the International Morticians Conglomerate, the Organ Providers of Idaho and America's Free Trade Agreement Lobby, commonly known as OPIAFTA, the Skeet Shooters and Street Shooters Association, the Beanie Baby Machine Gunners, and the Canyon County ATV Safari Challenge Adventures Club. I'm confident that I will once again win the endorsement of several really honestly nonpartisan and totally objective interest groups that just happen to be chaired by the chairs of the political party of which I happen to be a lifelong member. You all know what party that is, and I'm sure you'll all agree that there is no other party in Idaho. So in conclusion, many people say, Uma, as an unopposed candidate, why go to all these pesky forums? For me, the answer is a no-brainer. I love my constituents, and I want them to have a chance to get a full frontal view of their coroner before they go to the polls and punch the only Chad they can punch for coroner, Umatilla Kennewick. Thank you.
Thank you, Umatilla. Well, as I was saying before, we have a contested election this cycle, and as it turns out, both of these candidates are here today. It is my official duty as an elected elections official to officially accept the candidacy forms submitted by one Ukiah Digby for the office of county coroner, and to officially offer his opportunity to announce his candidacy at this public official forum. Mr. Digby?
What? You didn't tell me about this, Jenny. This is an outrage. How dare you humiliate me by unveiling an opponent at the last minute?
I sent you an email, and the candidates were posted on the official elections office website. But at any rate, I'm very sorry, Umatilla, but there's nothing in the elections code requiring that the official elections officiator must provide advance notification of contested office status to incumbents. Please, Uma, with all due respect for your revered and honored quarter century of service to the office of coroner, please get off the stage so Ukiah Digby can officially announce his candidacy.
Hello, I'm Ukiah Digby, and like most Americans, I have long been skeptical of all politics and politicians. The only reason to run for office, or so I used to always think, was to boost one's own ego or line one's own pockets. I have always voted faithfully, but cynically, choosing the candidate with fewer bad ideas or the less worse record. As a community activist, I've come to realize that most people who hold public office are actually good people caught up in a bad system. But in the last few years, I've also seen the dark side of politics threaten to take over all that's good. And when I had all but given up hope, I met a young woman who had become mayor of her town, and with the help of her team of energetic, young, and old reformers, created a model for towns and cities all over this nation. And that's when I had my epiphany. I needed to stop complaining about the government and become the government, the kind of government that I had envisioned, a government by the people and for the people. When I told friends about my plan, they said, "You can't win." And I said, "I've already won. Because even if I don't win the election this time, I still know that I will have served the greater good by bringing new ideas and energy into the realm of local politics." In Idaho, many candidates have run unopposed for many years. And because of that, we have all missed a chance to reevaluate what we really expect from our government. I am the first and only challenger to incumbent Umatilla Kennewick since 1978. And I look forward to a fascinating discussion of ideas that have long been taken for granted. For over a decade, I have volunteered and made a career of working for nonprofit organizations. I have always believed that one must make the place they live their true home by embracing community service. I have come to believe that one of the highest forms of community service is to serve in government, to make sure our future is guided by citizens who understand the everyday struggles of our neighbors, even in death. That's why I'm running for coroner. And that's why I hope you will vote for me this November 3rd.
Well, that was interesting. Now, it is the time when my official role as officiator comes to its termination, and I may formally invite questions from the press and public. Anyone? Anyone?
Stan Popovsky here, columnist from the Idaho Registry and Columnary. Why would you challenge a coroner who has been coroner for 28 years? Who has the support of the Chamber of Commerce and the International Morticians Conglomerate? A coroner who almost never declared a live person dead or a dead person alive. Why? What gives you the right? Are you saying she's corrupt? Are you trying to say she is unfit for the job?
Listen, I don't want to run an attack campaign. Coroner Kennewick is reasonably responsive to the public and is, competent, but...
I agree. She is competent. You said it yourself. And if she's competent and she's already there, then no one should think about voting for anyone else. Case closed.
Stan, please, let me finish. I know I don't have the soundbite thing quite down yet, but...
Exactly. By your own admission, you're incompetent in the area of soundbites. It is honorable that citizens want to run for public office, and maybe someday, after working your way through the ranks by cleaning toilets and waxing floors in the coroner's office, and then getting appointed to the Citizens Advisory Committee on Neighborhood Cemeteries, and then taking me out to lunch and hearing my perspective as a respected member of the Fifth Column, then maybe you could be a viable candidate for the position.
Okay, here's my sound bites. Quicker turnaround on death certification and inquests. Reducing the grief of survivors and saving taxpayers' funds. End to favoritism and nepotism in state coroner and cemetery-related contracts, saving taxpayers' funds. Greater transparency of coroner's office and better access of public to coronary issues so the public can better understand the coroner's office role in the cycles of life through declarations, inquests, and autopsies. For more details, go to my website, Ukiah4, that's numeral 4, coroner.com.
Well, Marlene, just a few weeks after your graduation from political science school and your first day as political campaign manager, how do you think I did?
Kinda bad, but you look like an honest person, and you're tall. For bland, pokey, way-off-path guy to say you might be viable someday is practically an endorsement for a non-incumbent.
I'll take whatever I can get.
Tune in next week for part 2 of Ukiah Digby for Coroner on the Sagebrush Variety Show.
Do you really want to spend your summer moving in squares, sucking up views? Or you're gonna force your kids to waste their youth? Piling up...
The Sagebrush Players have been harvesting food from the Sagebrush Variety Show farm and reporting to our listeners on its progress since May, reviewing a new crop nearly every week until now, 21 in all. And there are still carrots, onions, leeks, and scallions in the ground, a few hardy lettuce plants growing under a garden blanket, and an impressive plot of kale from which we can expect regular meals throughout the winter. And the interesting thing is that we're not the master gardeners or urban homesteaders we wish we were. We focused a little more intensely and worked a little harder this year than in years past, but it never felt like a chore. On the contrary, on top of the basic inherent pleasure of tending living plants, we were continually inspired, knowing that what we were doing has become an act of rebellion. A defiant expression of self-sufficiency in the face of attempts by agribusiness to corner the market on food production. An act of solidarity with small farmers slammed by meritless lawsuits from multi-billion dollar corporations. A protest of the degradations of pesticide abuse and the reckless pursuit of dangerous genetic technologies. A revolution against the predatory economics that are co-opting the organic food movement only to reverse the standards it was created to protect. And not incidentally, an act of self-defense in the event we may need these skills if the dwindling petroleum supply forces radical changes in the way everything is made and distributed. According to food archaeologists, hot peppers have been attractive to hunter-gatherers of this hemisphere for as much as 10,000 years. They were one of the first cultivated crops of the Americas. Columbus was one of the first Europeans to encounter them, and is most likely the one responsible for the confusing practice of sharing their name with the pepper of salt and pepper fame. It's possible he simply wasn't very refined, but it's also possible that he wanted to pass them off as a close relative of black pepper in order to prove that he had found a new direct nautical route to Asia, the source of that spice at that time, and the destination he was paid to visit. Europeans weren't quick to incorporate the spicy peppers for their cuisine, although physicians of the time recognized their medicinal uses. On the other hand, when European sailors introduced the plants to Asia, the fruit was so quickly and thoroughly adopted that many still argue that the plant is native to India, China, Korea, or Japan. Later, milder varieties made their way back to Europe via the trade routes of Central Asia and Turkey, and the barely hot paprika was adopted as the national spice of Hungary. Chili peppers popularly refer to several species in the botanical genus Capsicum, which comes from the Greek for capto, meaning to bite. Capsicum annuum is the species which most North American grocery store peppers belong. Annuum tend to be easy to grow, and despite the impression the name might give, are perennials that can be kept alive for years, bearing fruit constantly. Tabasco peppers belong to a different species, Capsicum frutescens, along with some lesser-known but even more delicious varieties that appeal to modern-day hunter-gatherer wannabes. The round, super-hot peppers that have more recently gained notoriety, such as habanero and Scotch bonnet, belong to the Capsicum chinensis species. The trickiest cultivated species for most casual growers is Capsicum pubescens. The rocoto pepper, which is as hot as a habanero, but with a much sweeter and fuller body to support that heat, is of that species. And recently gaining favor with growers are peppers of the Capsicum baccatum species, also referred to as ajis, which produce peppers that are harder to handle and market, but are ideal for home use, due to their productivity and ease of growing. The Sagebrush Farm plants some of all the species, and so, even in our worst years, have always been rewarded by a respectable number of the tasty ají peppers. The high vitamin C content of peppers aids in the uptake of iron in beans and grains, and hot peppers have been shown to reduce the amount of insulin the body needs to lower blood sugar levels after a meal by up to 60%. Capsaicin, derived from peppers, is used to treat auto-inflammatory diseases, such as rheumatoid arthritis, and, as we all know, does wonders for a stuffy nose. In late October, we moved our strongest pepper plants inside, where we continue to grow and harvest them, although we may be losing ground in our battle against aphids, the scourge of indoor pepper gardeners. We try to shy away from the vulgar practice of defining peppers by their heat alone. Too many self-defined pepper aficionados become obsessed with the Scoville heat ranking of this habanero over that Dorset Naga or Red Savina. However, we are not immune to the perverse pleasure of continually pushing our own tolerance levels, even to the point of pain, followed by the buzz of an endorphin release, as you can hear in this week's reactions.
Very sweet, but not like a bell pepper.
No, much more complex. Fruitier.
Fruity.
Yeah.
More of a genuine citrus edge.
I've never tasted a pepper like that before. Really pleasant.
It's more like a hot pepper without the heat.
This one is hotter.
Ooh,
yeah.
It's extremely hot.
Yep, that is very hot.
Oh my.
That's not temporary. That one takes no prisoners.
Oh man.
Like a little nuclear warhead. There's no flavor. It's
an annuum.
Oh, I think there's plenty of flavor. It reminds me a little bit of tequila. I taste kind
now
of
I'm
grassy.
Getting a flavor.
That pepper hurts my teeth. It's so hot.
Really? Maybe it's the section I got, but all I have is a mild earbud.
It's like piercing into the roots of my molars.
Blade just got my tongue.
But I must say, it doesn't spread. I've had other peppers where it just spreads to like your toes.
It's hot, but first you get papaya. Papaya flavor fills out, and then the heat comes in, spreads it out, went straight to my nose. Instead of down my mouth, it went up. Now it's tickling my nose hairs. Now it's coming out to my ears. The heat part. I can still taste the papaya.
Oh, wow. Glad this is only temporary.
Oh, my. I just touched it to the tip of my tongue. Mm.
Wow, now it's
and I'm overwhelmed.
My lips. This one's not contained. It's spreading. Oh. It's taking over my mouth. It's like somebody just is going crazy with Edward's Scissorhands just going inside my mouth and just trashing it.
You guys are babies.
It's quite an experience.
Oh, this is very fruity.
See, I told you.
Very hot. Very hot. It activates my opioids, although it's not as hot as the last one.
It's not doing anything to my nose.
Yeah, but your earlobes are bright red.
If you have an interesting overwinter crop or indoor gardening project, we'd love to hear from you. Or share with us what you do to satisfy the growing impulse during the dreary gardenless winter months. Visit our website at sagebrushvariety.org for tips on how you can say no to corporate food.
For most so-called transplants to Idaho, the wise approach is to keep their complaints to themselves and focus on how happy, happy, happy they are to have moved here and, hey buddy, can you spare a decent job? But in today's Essay of the Week, former New Yorker Marlene Rosnick admits she had a bad day.
Sometimes I find it almost impossible to explain my life in Idaho to those who have never been here. So it was recently. One day, I was pedaling home on the bicycle, exhausted after a full day of work and a round of errands downtown. I was in a reverie about how good it was to be getting my exercise rather than sitting in a metal box on my required commute. I was congratulating myself on the fuel money I was saving, especially with gas prices rising. I was calculating how, between the increasing reality of traffic jams in Boise and the new bike shortcut I had just discovered, I might be getting home by the fastest mode of transportation. And I was flashing back to the months before I left New York City when I often had to explain to dumbfounded friends why I had decided to move to Idaho. I had many explanations, but today I was remembering the times I would say, Boise has been repeatedly named the most bike-friendly city in the nation by bicycle groups. The weather is much better for bicycling than here, hardly any rain and warm daytime temperatures most of the year. Loads of bike paths, a green belt, and the drivers are not nearly as aggressive. Good thing, they'd remark ruefully, since you're one of those lifelong New Yorkers who has never felt the need to get a driver's license. But bike-friendly or not, everyone knows New York City is the only place where you can live without ever driving. I was flushed with self-congratulatory pride, thinking about how very wrong my ironically provincial New York City pals turned out to be, when somewhere between Protest Road and Broadway, with nothing but concrete and weeds in sight, the bike began rattling as if riding over a bumpy surface. But I was on a smooth stretch of an otherwise bumpy path, and I instantly knew the worst. A flat rear tire. I glanced around at the lack of shade in this hot, sunny, late summer afternoon, then switched my mind to the patch kit buried in my backpack under pounds of ripe tomatoes, peaches, and a small melon. I'd carefully packed these heavy but delicate items into my bag at the store. Now I was alone and had no good surface on which to unload it. I hoped I was mistaken about the tire and it just needed more air. I was not. I was angry, knowing immediately that the flat was the result of altering my trip home when I decided to brave the fast, quieter route home along the canal that I'd previously avoided. Finally, in the middle of September, goathead season, I stupidly decided to give it a try, easing my skinny wheeled road bike across its puncture vine infested and bumpy rock-strewn surface. Goathead, otherwise known as puncture vine, or scientifically, Tribulus terrestris, is a mischievous invasive weed notorious in southwest Idaho, especially among bicyclists. This was the revenge of the sheep brought into this area, puncturevine copiously buried in their wool. Now I was paying the price for that bad shortcut decision as I stood under the blazing sun on a rocky trail, with not a soul around, staring at my crippled bicycle. As I often do at such moments, I wonder why the hell I ever moved to Idaho. Most bicycle-friendly city? Who paid that committee off? With the proper equipment, I used to be able to ride over broken glass and metal rubble without any problem. Here, I am constantly threatened by the invincible, needle-pointed goat heads everywhere I go. I decided to save myself further indignity. This was a time for help. I dialed my husband's number on my cell phone, a device I long shunned in disgust over rude New Yorkers repeating their shopping lists or describing their latest skin rash at top volume on the subway. Now, in a compromise, I bought one of the damn things for occasions such as this very one. Thankfully, my husband was not in one of the cell phone dead zones, which still exist in Idaho. "Where are you?" he asked. "About halfway between Protest Road and Broadway," I replied. "Can you come help me?" "You're closer to Woodbine," he informed me, apropos of nothing, for he later admitted there was no access to that canal from Woodbine. "So what is the nearest cross street?" he asked. "Cross street? I can't see any cross streets out here. I'm along the canal," I responded. "I'm below street level." "What?" he asked. "Below Federal Way? Are there any landmarks around?" he continued helplessly. "Landmarks?" I looked around. "There's a canal. And the road above me. And a big pipe." In the end, he offered to ride out along the canal to meet me, which I tried to explain was probably a bad idea for all the goat heads growing in the path. In frustration, I told him to forget it. I was almost sad my city friends and relatives were not there to witness my surreal predicament. Then, resolving myself, I began unloading the delicate contents of my backpack to get to the spare tube and patch kit. At least, I thought, I'm rugged enough to take care of these things myself. As I wrestled to get my extra-thick and rigid Armadillo-brand tire from my skinny rim, a bright orange and noxious-smelling jelly splurted out menacingly. I had completely forgotten about the day I begrudgingly allowed a well-meaning bicycle mechanic to fill my tubes with the gel, which he was convinced would miraculously transform my tubes into self-sealing, never-deflating wonders. As I painstakingly wiped the gunk from my Mr. Tuffy tire liners, another ostensible goathead repellent, and wondered how many irritants I was now absorbing through my skin, it seemed like none of my goathead proofing was working, and all of it was making a bad day that much worse. At long last, I had everything more or less clean and two punctures patched, or so I hoped. To my great dismay, I found that the tip of my tire pump had cracked off, and I wasn't going to be able to use it. I probably could have walked home by now. At that same moment, a fellow traveler, a former bike messenger from Portland, stopped, and in 10 minutes I was good to go with my newly inflated tube. Grateful for his help, I did not contradict his assessment that no one in their right mind would bother trying to patch a tube in Goathead Town. And I wondered if maybe my environmental and economic commitment to reducing waste by insisting on patching wasn't perhaps more trouble than it was worth. I rode home gingerly, fearing for my tires, and rightfully so, for when I arrived, weary and grumpy, I had, yes, another flat tire. My husband shook his head. He pointed to his bike, both its tires flattened on the ground, and I had to admit to myself the unthinkable. Sometimes, bicycle commuting in Idaho can be just a little bit too much for me.
Homeland Security, Level Red. The price of security is eternal surveillance. If you have nothing to hide, then you won't mind if we sneak a little peek.
Good evening. For those of you who don't already know me, I'm Shauna Robinson, spokesperson for the local office of the Army Corps of Engineers. I want to thank everyone for coming out this evening to discuss fish, when I think it would be safe to say most of you would rather be fishing. But as I'm sure you folks know, How migratory fish get around the dam in order to complete their life cycle is not just about your own chances of catching a sweet bass or walleye, although that's pretty important.
Yeah.
It's also about the $500 million in total dollars recreational fishing brings to our communities. And if you ain't catching sturgeon, the tourists definitely ain't, and that means they won't be coming back. And in the back of your mind, you're thinking, fewer Turons means more fish for me. But then you're going to notice all those tourist dollars you're not reeling in, and that, my friends, is a problem. So when we invest your tax dollars in restoring fish populations, we want you involved. As sport fishers, but also as people who gotta make a buck. It's not just the law that makes us have these public meetings. It's that we really want to have you on board. So we're going to give you a fair and balanced synopsis of all the possible options available. Listen to your comments, then forget all about what you said and choose the option to make sure the Army Corps of Engineers doesn't plan ourselves out of a job. No, just kidding. We'll heavily weigh public opinion when it comes time to make the final decision.
You know, that's not even close to funny. A lot of people, including me, already wonder if these public meetings are just dog and pony shows. I say it's really disrespectful
Pardon
of you.
Pardon me, Mr. Bensonhurst. I believe you're speaking out of turn. The time for public comment is after my presentation. Oh, hi, Way. Everyone, I just thought everyone might want to know that we are fortunate tonight to have Way Offman from the Idaho Columnary and Registry's top environmental reporter in the audience covering tonight's presentation. That was a great piece last week on the environmental and humane advantages of organic beef production by corporate feedlots. It's an honor to have you here, Way.
The pleasure's all mine, but I do have to warn you, I may have to give you the hardball treatment tonight.
Ooh, I'm looking forward to it.
Yuck.
All right then, let me start up this pointer power presentation. As you can see here, a fish banging its head against the dam wall, next slide, equals a dead fish, next slide. Equals a frowning tourist, next slide. Equals a local resident, like you folks, with an empty wallet, next slide. Big question mark. So what do? We propose a two-phase approach, next slide. First, a study phase where we use a cool technology to electronically track the number and types of area river fish, next slide. Find out where they hang out, next slide. What they like to do and what makes them happy, and, next slide. How many can get past the dam now? If we tag at least 225 fish, we'll have some really awesome data. Next slide. Then we take that data to construct stuff that'll keep the fish happy and breeding. Check out some of the cool slides we mocked up here. Next slide. Water level control. Next slide. Island building. Next slide. And the piece de resistance. Next slide. These nifty little channels, like secret passages for fish that go around the dam. And all this will take a modest 15 years and $1.58 billion. Next slide. Whoa, that's a lot of money, you're saying? Let me show you that slide of you with a moth flying out of your empty wallet again. Okay, some of you cheapskates are probably still thinking there must be some alternatives. So let's be fair and show them. Next slide. Adjusting dam gates or assist passage through locks. Uh-oh, looks like there's no electricity in town. Next slide. Building a rock ramp of varying levels and sizes of rocks to accommodate different sizes of fish and to provide resting areas as they make their way up the river. Uh-oh, looks like that fish dried up in the sun and is starting to stink. Next slide. Oh my, looks like someone gave the environmentalists their way and are blowing the dam to smithereens. That looks pretty crazy, so I guess that's not feasible either. Next slide. So I guess that pretty much says it all. There are no other options. Any questions?
Could we fish in the channel?
That might be too easy to be sporting and could damage the population overall, but we were thinking of having special seasonal events where children just learning about the sport can have fun. So I think it's clear what the best option is. I guess that wraps this up.
Well, before everyone just leaves, I'd like to go on record once again that we don't need to waste resources. And I mean money, materials, and the time of workers who could be hired for true public works on a fish channel that most likely won't even work, when the dam itself doesn't do us any good and is an ecological disaster. I fail to see why you presented the dam removal option as some kind of cartoon joke, when it's not only a credible approach, but in fact is the only sensible one.
Okay, thanks for your input. I guess that really does wrap it up. Good night, everyone. Way.
Hey, Shauna, any word on what the top brass of the Army Corps of Engineers thought of my resume? You think I might get hired as a spokesperson? I sure am keen on that job.
Well, Way, it all depends on how the article goes. Just kidding. We wouldn't expect you to be anything but your truly professional self.
Of course, of course. You know I always call him as I see him. And I see a corner office in the PR department. Just kidding. Can you believe that Bensonhurst? I can't believe he listened to your entire presentation and still came away wanting to blow up that dam.
Yeah, you should put that in your article. Show everyone that we considered every crackpot idea before we went ahead with our brilliant plan.
Hoffman, where's that article? You've got 6 minutes till deadline. You better not be working on your resume again. You know we encourage our journalists to move on to public relations and seal our good relationships with the corporate ruling class, but I'm still an old-fashioned hard-nosed editor. When you're on columnary time, you better be banging out those love letters to local businesses and neoconservative government cheerleading.
No worries, boss. You're gonna love this.
Let me see it. Well, well, well. Nice work indeed. Very colorful yet respectful way to catalog the natural wisdom of dominant views while marginalizing minority views that might otherwise gain some dangerous traction.
Thanks.
One thing, though, and I promised I'd trust you, but I have to ask. Did Bensonhurst really threaten to blow up that dam?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, I mean, the problem with Bensonhurst has always been that we have to cut him right out of our articles because he makes radical ideas seem kind of reasonable. After he ran for state senate and got 33% of the vote, we spent the next 2 years editing rookie reporters who would try and write in all those quotable sound bites he was offering them. I mean, if I can quote some angry or inarticulate freak at a street protest, it helps reassure average folks that things are the way they are for good reason. Problem with Bensonhurst is we could never catch him saying something like, "I want to blow up that dam."
That's what he said.
Great, great. Did you get it on tape?
Nah, I accidentally turned the recorder off when I went for my cell phone.
But you sure you're not changing what he said? I mean, not substantially.
No way. I swear on a stack of Bibles.
You're a real professional.
Agent Bailey here. Yeah, boss. I'm totally working on a case here. I know you can see me reading the paper, but that's where I get my best leads. You think I'd actually read for fun? Come on. I'm a G-man. If I wanted to goof off, I'd be watching a Steven Seagal flick, right? Yep. Glad you agree. No, really. I promise you at least once a month I find something in the paper that allows me to preemptively fight terrorism. Remember that massive terrorist gluing of all the keyholes in the State House last month?
Yeah.
Of course you don't. I stopped it from happening when I read an article in the school district newsletter about the rapidly dwindling supply of rubber cement. I traced it to a cell of first graders taking rubber cement balls home, and after I went to their house and questioned them, their little plan fell through. Of course that's what they were planning. One of them had a drawing of the State House in his book bag. Anyway, I should get back to work, right? Bye. Bingo.
Martin Bensonhurst here.
Good morning, Mr. Bensonhurst. I'm Agent Bill Bailey with the FBI.
Oh yeah, great work you guys are doing in Alaska on that bribery case between Vico Energy and those Alaska legislators.
What? Oh yeah, that's public corruption. I don't know any of those guys. Anyway, Are you by any chance planning on blowing up the dam?
What?
Did you read the paper this morning?
No, I haven't gotten to that. Why?
Hey, dude, you ever read Monkey Wrench Gang? Awesome book. Know what I'm saying?
No.
Really? I thought you checked it out.
Oh, are you actually going through my library records?
No. I was just making a lucky guess.
Listen, are you going to charge me with something? Because I'm thinking maybe I don't want to talk with you until I contact a lawyer.
Oh, man. Have you been reading those National Lawyers Guild pamphlets? I hate that. I just want to rap with you. If you don't have anything to hide, then we cool.
Okay. Against my better judgment, I'm going to talk to you, but please stop trying to be hip with me. I'm turning 40 next weekend, so I'm not really up on the latest colloquialisms anyway.
Okay, will do. And happy birthday. Say, what does your license plate mean, Breachum?
It means, I think dams, as a general and almost exceptionless rule, do more harm than good for all concerned, and should be removed. Particularly the one in my backyard. Everybody knows that about me.
And you've been saying that for many years. You must be feeling kind of frustrated.
Yeah, I'm frustrated. So?
According to the newspaper, in the heat of the moment, you blurted out a plan to blow up the dam.
No, I didn't. Hold on a second. Let me get that article online. I'm near the computer right now. Oh, way off man strikes again.
Isn't that Wade Hoffman?
No, it's Way Hoffman. Listen, call up some of the people who were there. Shauna Robinson started her presentation with a picture of a dam being blown up.
How do you spell that?
Shauna Robinson's with the Army Corps of Engineers.
Are you saying she's infiltrated the Army Corps?
Agent Bailey, the safest way to remove a dam before it bursts from disrepair or in order to restore the ecological balance of a place or any of the other sanctioned reasons to remove a dam, you have to blow it up under controlled circumstances. I think they should do that. And I've been legally advocating it for years now. At that meeting, what I literally said was, dam removal is not only a credible approach, but in fact the only sensible one.
Really?
Yes. Ask anyone who was at that meeting. Except the journalist professionally trained for observation, of course.
I will do that. Don't leave town, okay?
It's Labor Day weekend.
Where are you going?
You know what? I promise I'll be back Tuesday.
Oh, yeah. Holy moly. It's 4:55. I gotta go.
You know, I'm feeling kind of harassed, especially with the library thing.
Sorry. We have to check everything out.
Do you really?
This was a dramatization, a comic dramatization, but in the world of audio theater, it is said that truth is stranger than fiction. Imagine if you will. No, don't imagine. Look it up on the Associated Press. One Jim Bensman remarks during a public hearing that instead of building a channel so migratory fish could go around a dam on the Mississippi River, just get rid of the dam. A controversial view, no doubt, but innocent enough. Now let's go further back in time, an hour or so back, to the beginning of the meeting where the Army Corps of Engineers spokesperson admitted that one option for restoring migratory fish populations to the river would be removing the dam, comment accompanied by a PowerPoint slide of an exploding dam. Now picture a journalist, Linda N. Weller of The Telegraph, perhaps a jerk, more likely just a moron, a bad listener or a bad writer, or both. Working under deadline pressure, wrongly attributing a quote. And finally, a public servant, Agent Alan Dooley, obsessively driven to investigate everything. Seems too silly to be true. Believe it.
Homeland Security, Level Red, was written by Robert McMinn and was performed and produced by the Sagebrush Variety Show with the help of a grant from the Green Institute and support from Radio Boise. Learn more about the topics in this show at sagebrushvariety.org. This week's Sagebrush Variety Show was conceived, written, performed, and produced by Robert McMinn, Kevin Bayhouse, April Hoy, and Gwen Sankirico, and was funded in part by a grant from the Green Institute. For more information on the content discussed on this program, visit our website at sagebrushvariety.org. Write to us at sagebrush@radioboise.org. Thanks for listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show.